My family fully supports it.
Singh talked about how his brother moved from Fiji and became a U.S. citizen to pursue his dream of becoming a police officer. It turns out the Newman police corporal was shot and killed during a traffic stop in December, allegedly by an immigrant who was in the country illegally. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
A winter storm is affecting much of the country, with up to 8 inches of snow predicted for St. Louis, Indianapolis, Washington, D.C., and Pittsburgh. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less, guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
As we continue in 2019, maybe your goal was to create some better habits. James Clear is author of the book Atomic Habits, and he shares with me one of the things that all successful Fortune 500 companies do, along with sports teams.
Well, this is true for life in general, which is that things change. The environment evolves. Things are different. You know, if you look at the NBA, for example, the way that the game is played now is very different, honestly, even than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but certainly than 20 years ago. And so if teams remain stagnant and continue to play in the way that they previously did, at some point the rest of the league moves on and they're behind the curve. And so ultimately, whether you're an athlete or working in a Fortune 500 company or just trying to improve your personal life, the thing that you need to commit to is this philosophy of trying to get 1% better each day, trying to carve out that small advantage or a little margin for improvement. And I think the beautiful thing about that philosophy is that it's not only being committed to continuous improvement, it's also manageable. It's doable. Anybody can get 1% better. You can try to find some small thing to improve today, but it's really about waking up each day and having that mindset, having the willingness to try to dig and find that. Where can I get some small gain? And if you do that day in and day out, you'll be surprised by how much progress you can make over the course of a year and certainly over the course of decades.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
On Thursday, November 8th, from 2 till 7 p.m., the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce will be holding its 30th annual... On Thursday, November 8th, from 2 till 7 p.m., the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce will be holding its 30th annual Business Expo and Food Showcase.
Join the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce and the Flemington Community Partnership for their Card Club networking event hosted by Northfield Bank on Thursday, September 28th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Northfield Bank's Flemington office right here on Main Street. For details and to RSVP, visit hunterdon-chamber.org or call 908-782-7115. See you there.
Well, hi. It's Friday afternoon and a few minutes after 4. I'm Pat Smits, your host for It's So Law. Excuse me for playing spots that they've not given us some new ones, so we have to go through this to make sure that we're not still doing the expo. And hopefully somebody will get on the ball and update these soon. In any event, what's happening today with the weather? It's been cold, of course. Today, the temperature has been about 32 degrees. Tonight, it could go down to low of about 13 degrees, so it's going to get cold out there. By tomorrow, however, we're back to freezing, partly sunny. So it'll be cold, partly sunny, high of about 32 degrees. So be very careful. There should be, hopefully there aren't any ice spots or black ice, but that's always a problem at this time of year. Tomorrow night, Saturday, there is a 60% chance of snow, and it should not be rain or probably not even sleet because the low is expected to be about 24 degrees. Again, on Sunday, there is a slight chance of snow, only about 20%, but again, temperature is not going to get above freezing, or should not be getting above freezing according to the predictions. By Sunday night, it's a low of about 19 degrees. But then on Monday, we should have mostly sunny day, warm spell, high of about 35 degrees. And again, Monday night, partly cloudy, low of about 20 degrees. So we're going to have seasonable weather, to say the very least. So let me play a couple spots, and then I'll be back with talking about some of the legal cases, including one that has to do with football tickets for the case came up as a result of sale of football tickets for the 2014 Super Bowl. So we'll talk about some other things, of course, also. So stay tuned, and let's see, we can have some spots from our good sponsors.
Join the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce and the Flemington Community Partnership for their Card Club networking event hosted by Northfield Bank on Thursday, September 28th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Northfield Bank's Flemington office right here on Main Street. For details and to RSVP, visit Hunterdon-.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi.
Sabía que.
This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our restaurant showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location.
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
I'm going to try another spot on my list, but I do think that this is also something that was for the expo. I'll get rid of it if it is.
This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo.
Sorry about that. I'm right. Half of our spots, because this is an old list, are out of date. So let's talk about what's going on in the law. And one of the things that I am going to talk about is the Third Circuit has rejected a challenge over the RNC voter suppression in 2016. This was a federal appellate court, and they rejected the Democratic National Convention's legal challenge against the Republican counterpart, in which it argued that the GOP operatives worked with the Trump campaign to suppress minority votes in a lead up to the 2016 presidential election. Of course, this is this is not the end of that because of all the other investigations, but at least this federal appellate court rejected that. The the question that is always coming up with attorneys is it's really not worth the risk to do business with our clients. And also, if you're a business person, you know, you need to be very careful to go into business with an attorney, only because those transactions can be fraught with problems. And, of course, the attorney is the one who has most of the risk. But that's another reminder that's coming out today. I will talk later about the fact that our Supreme Court did not find any fraud in the NFL Super Bowl ticket sales and the practices that they engage in. I think most of the Supreme Court in New Jersey finally, in the ruling, said that the NFL ticket sale practices for the 2014 Super Bowl did not violate the state's Consumer Fraud Act. What is, to me, shocking as a big fan is how few of these tickets actually go to the public. But that's another story. So there was also another appeal. This is a contract dispute resolution. The defendant was a home warranty company in Florida, and it was a Supreme Court decision. And in this case, the home warranty folks appealed from the decision of the appellate division, which affirmed the trial court's denial of their motion to dismiss. And this came about because the plaintiff purchased a home service agreement from the defendants. When the plaintiff became dissatisfied with the service, she filed an action alleging the agreement misrepresented the length of coverage and the mediation section of the agreement was deceptively labeled and failed to inform her that she was waiving her right to jury trial and to treble damages. So, and under consumer fraud, if someone brings a case and they succeed, there is a provision for treble, what we call treble damages, which means three times the amount. And apparently this contract also, she had to waive her rights to not only a jury trial, to treble damages, to punitive damages, and legal fees and costs. So, of course, it would be very difficult for most consumers to file suit and follow through if they're not going to be able to have any opportunity to have their fees, legal fees, reimbursed. So the defendants in this case, this was this home warranty company in Florida, they moved to dismiss in favor of arbitration because that was what the agreements, pursuant to the agreement's alternative dispute resolution provision. And in this case, the trial court denied the motion, ruling that the agreement's arbitration provision was unenforceable because it failed, in this case, to unambiguously inform consumers that they were agreeing to arbitrate all disputes and waived their right to a jury trial. So that's what happened, and the appellate division affirmed the appeal from the appellate division. The Supreme Court affirmed the trial court and the appellate division, ruling that the arbitration provision in the parties' agreement failed to support finding mutual assent to a confusing, contradictory, and in places misleading provisions. So the language in this agreement, the provision language, was so ambiguous, confusing, contradictory, and even misleading that the court did not uphold it. The court noted that the provision repeatedly shifted between the terms mediation and arbitration, and its text was of such small size and font to be burdensome to read. In effect, the court found that the provision would fail to convey to an ordinary consumer that arbitration was a required method of dispute resolution. And in a concurring opinion, that means that the justice agreed, but he wrote a separate opinion. And in this case, it was Justice Albin. And he argued that the court should have also addressed whether New Jersey's jurisprudence ran afoul of the Federal Arbitration Act and the federal case law, contending that the court would reaffirm the vitality of existing jurisprudence. So in any event, this was a, and I'm not sure if it was unanimous, but certainly it was a situation where this contract was not going to pass muster. And it's important for any contracts, when it's especially a contract when the person signing it has very little opportunity, if any, to change it. So I think this is a very important decision, and it's certainly important for attorneys to make sure that they write these agreements and contracts not to run afoul of this case. So the next case I wanted to talk about was a Chancery Division case, actually, a decision. And it was a case where the plaintiff moved for final approval of a class action settlement in an action arising from a merger in which one defendant acquired the other. And the plaintiff, in this case, a shareholder of the acquired entity, filed suit alleging that the acquired entity's board breached its fiduciary duties by approving the merger. So the parties reached a settlement which required defendants to release supplemental disclosure to ensure stockholders were better informed when voting on the merger, and also to pay plaintiffs' attorneys' fees and costs. Plaintiff's motion was unopposed by defendants, and plaintiffs sought to approve the settlement, certifying the proposed class, and certifying the plaintiff as class representative, and to appoint the plaintiff's counsel as a class counsel, and to grant plaintiff's application for an award of attorney's fees and costs. So the court granted plaintiff's motion, and the court ruled that the plaintiff's complaint was appropriate for a class action and that the plaintiff was suitable to represent the interest of the class. The court found that the matter met the requirements for what we call numerosity, meaning number of possible plaintiffs, commonality, and typicality, excuse my pronunciation of that one, because in this case the defendants alleged breach of fiduciary duty, and that would equally impact the thousands of shareholders. The court found no conflict between the plaintiff and the class and concluded that plaintiff's counsel had significant experience in litigating class actions. And I think that's important. I can't imagine most of us taking on a class action. The court further affirmed, meaning when I say most of us attorneys, the court further affirmed the proposed settlement as fair, reasonable, adequate, and providing a material benefit to the class. You know, that's always interesting because sometimes you probably, like me, have received a check for 22 cents because you were part of a class. I mean, you know, I won't go into my own views on some of these class action suits. But in any event, in this one, the court concluded that the expense of litigation would be substantial, especially in light of the uncertainty of the result of litigation, and noted that only one shareholder objected to the settlement. Although the court noted that the class obtained some but not all of the relief sought, the benefits obtained were material because the shareholders would now have more meaningful information regarding the value of their stock and also possible conflicts of interest in the transactions before deciding whether or not to vote for the merger. So that was upheld. Criminal law case, which was an appellate division, State versus Herbert. And in this case, the defendant appealed from his conviction for murder and related firearm offenses. At the trial, various witnesses to the murder testified that they failed to immediately speak to police out of fear for their and their family's safety, and ultimately only identified defendant out of photo arrays under pseudonyms. In other words, they were so afraid that they came in and they said, they didn't want to even identify themselves. Moreover, despite the trial court's orders, testifying law enforcement officials repeatedly injected the subject of gangs into their testimony. The trial court denied defendants' motions for a mistrial, instead issuing the jury what we call a curative instruction, directing them to disregard the testimony about gangs. Well, I can tell you that most attorneys will say it's very difficult to disregard certain things once we've heard it. And in fact, telling a jury to disregard it, I question sometimes whether that means that they're going to focus even more on it. But what happened in this case is ultimately the jury convicted the defendant. So then on appeal, the appellate court vacated the defendant's conviction, reversed the trial court's denial of defendant's motion for mistrial. And the appellate court noted that in certain circumstances, the prejudicial effect of impermissible testimony cannot be overcome by a curative instruction. I think this is just, what I said. The court noted that the U.S. Supreme Court had required an overwhelming probability, and that's in quotes, an overwhelming probability of jury noncompliance to find a curative instruction inadequate. Ultimately, the court concluded that the curative instruction in the present case was insufficient to cure the prejudicial impact of statements identifying the defendant as a gang member and stating that the murder occurred in a gang area. The appellate court also noted that the jury would have noticed the gang references as the trial they would have noticed the gang references because the trial ground to a halt after each reference, and the jury apparently grasped when one detective expressly referred to the defendant as a gang member. The court further noted that the reference to gangs supplied the motive element of the state's theory of the case. So the court held that tagging defendant as a gang member likely prejudiced the jury into thinking that the defendant was a bad person with a propensity to commit crimes. So the appellate court further held that the jury was likely to consider the detective statements to be true. So accordingly, the appellate division determined that the risk of jury noncompliance with the instructions was unacceptably high. This means that there would be a remand and they'd have to do a do-over. So those are, that's certainly important in the way of criminal, cases and facing whether or not there's the testimony or references are too prejudicial, because sometimes they really are. There are some things that are so prejudicial that there's a question whether the defendant could get a fair trial. So what else is happening in the way of there's a proposed new rule about the time for appeal from a denial of pretrial detention, and that's now proposed, and it's open for public comment. There's also a proposed amendment to a rule that seeks to exclude adult name change forms from public access. So in that case, the appellate office of the courts is seeking comments on proposed amendments to a rule. A rule is 1:38-3F, which would exclude from public access new confidential forms required for civil adult name change applications, which include personal identifiers. The judiciary has already excluded from public access the social security numbers of name change applicants and now seeks to protect from public access the social security numbers on two new forms. So the proposed new rule would add to the categories of documents excluded from public access the certification, and in this case, exclude the certification of confidential information for name change and the final judgment addendum. So this is, there's always a question of what should be open to public scrutiny. Now, there was a case where first impression, actually, Pennsylvania court affirmed the ruling of a workers' compensation judge, and the judge held that an industrial painter's injury claim from an accident he suffered under the Benjamin Franklin Bridge cannot be litigated in Pennsylvania because it happened on the New Jersey side of the Delaware River. Yeah, I guess we'll get down to the point where we have to figure out if somebody who floated, maybe floated on both sides. But in any event, that's the situation. It has to be tried in New Jersey. Note to attorneys, how to avoid liability for your client's representations, and apparently the act of drafting does not make the attorney responsible for the accuracy of the statement placed on the paper, unless, of course, the attorney files a certification. And the other question would be, though, what about things that the attorney, as I said, signs, such as certifications or legal briefs to the court, and puts in factual statements that are not true. And this happens often where attorneys will make not just representations, but they will state as truth something that really isn't true, and the attorney has no knowledge whether or not it's true. And so the question is whether or not the attorney should include such information, such statements. And I'm on the side of no, unless you say things like, the client alleged or apparently or in some other way show that you're not providing your truth. It's somebody else's truth. There was a tax issue, Nevins versus the director of the Division of Taxation, and that was reported on January 8th this week. So the parties in this case cross-moved for summary judgment on the plaintiff's challenge to their assessment for gross income tax deficiency. The plaintiff, sought to bar the directors, that's the director of the Division of Taxation, to bar the director's claim for deficiency and annul the final determination. And they allege the director failed to timely assess GIT within the application, within the applicable limitations. And so there is an applicable limitation period. And so in support of its motion to dismiss plaintiff's complaint with prejudice, the director asserted that the various exceptions to the statute of limitations applied because the plaintiffs failed to report one or more changes to their federal taxable income made by the IRS. So in other words, the IRS made changes. The plaintiffs did not report that to New Jersey. And so they were required to do that within 90 days of the final determination of such change. And the court denied plaintiff's motion for summary judgment and granted the director's motion to dismiss. The court ruled that the plaintiff's statute of limitations argument was without merit, noting that the three-year limitations period started in September 2010 when the plaintiffs filed their 2008 return. So apparently they did not file the return on time. The deadline for 2008 return would have been October of 2009. I had to think about that for a minute. So they didn't file it. Apparently they didn't file it on time. So in addition, the court held that limitations period was inapplicable due to the IRS correction. So that made it inapplicable. In addition, the court held that the limitations period was inapplicable due to the IRS correction. The court does also held that although the director was required to send notice of the deficiency because a taxpayer would be unaware of such deficiency, the director need not send a taxpayer a notice of the tax due for taxes shown as owed on a filed original amended return. The court noted that the plaintiffs acknowledged that they were aware of their tax liability when they submitted their amended return and simply elected not to submit any payment. Well, that's nice. Thus, the court held the plaintiff acted in their own detriment by waiting for a notice before remitting any payment. And finally, the court said and concluded that the IRS change to plaintiff's federal taxable income was final by November 2010, and that plaintiffs failed to timely report the final determination to the director, resulting in its authority to assess the gross tax and gross income tax at that time or at any time. So that's one of the things that I'm always very careful about is dealing with tax issues. Okay, let's take a couple breaks here and tell you who we need to look at for and support as our sponsors. And also, if I start playing something that's already happened and talking about an event that happened, I will stop as soon as possible and get back to supporting sponsors who should be supported. And by the way, I also have what I would consider a public service announcement. The shops at Flemington, there's a store called Zoop, Z-O-U-P, and they have soups, sandwiches, salads, and what they're doing on they're going to have an open mic, which is a showcase for local comics and musicians. And it's ages 16 and over for performances, for both the performers and the audience. And I'm pleased to announce that it's going to happen on January 19th, and will be between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. And as I said, this is at the Shops at Flemington Mall. They're located at 100 Rayville Avenue in Flemington. And if you have any other questions, you can talk to or contact McDavid Sobel, or Sobel, excuse me, S-O-B-E-L, and his can be contacted at djsobes@gmail.com. And you can pick that up for the listing information. So I think that it's nice to have something in Flemington, and of course, not of course, but there's no charge.
USA Radio News.
Republican Senator from South Carolina Lindsey Graham is urging the president to declare a national emergency for border wall funding. Graham took to Twitter to tell the president, build the wall now. Graham also says,
I have never been more depressed about moving forward than right now. I just don't see a pathway forward.
Wisconsin police say they have arrested Jake Patterson for the kidnapping of 13-year-old Jamie Kloss and the murder of her parents. Kloss was found in Gordon, Wisconsin, which is about 40 miles southeast of Duluth, Minnesota. FBI Special Agent Justin Tolomo talks about the case.
This case was challenging given the proactive steps the subject took to avoid detection. In cases like this, we often need a big break, and it was Jamie herself who gave us that break.
According to Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald, Jamie is doing well and looking to be reunited with her aunt soon. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
With a recession ending, if you've been putting off building your business, now is the time to act. General Steel will meet or beat any price on a pre-engineered steel building of the same size and specifications. Act now before steel prices go up. So call us today for free information.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290, 800-965-1290.
I don't usually comment on the news, but I think I will in this case. The border wall, I have to comment on this because if anyone thinks that a border wall will really keep people out, they're so mistaken. I mean, we've never learned anything about the Maginot Line, what happened when they tried to keep people out of East Berlin, etc. But in this case, so much of the border between the United States and Mexico is in the mountains where people really can't pass through. I know they've been showing pictures of the border wall that apparently somebody's been able to cut through. You can't tell if that's what's in the middle of those steel columns because it just seems to me very strange that if you put up steel columns and filled them, even if they were hollow, and filled them with concrete, that anybody could saw through that. But more than that, one of the things that I want to comment on, because people in this part of the country, most people have not seen the border walls. I've been to Arizona. I've seen the walls. And certainly in southern Arizona, when there's in areas where there are populations, they're not only do they have the border walls, but they have Border Patrol in Border Patrol vehicles. And at least where I, you know, was recently at the wall, the people in the vehicle, the Border Patrol agents in the vehicles, had clear sight that they would have been able to see anyone who even started to try to saw through the wall. Now, you know, perhaps it's somewhat more difficult at night, but if you see what they have down there and the drones and the night lights and all of the things, but more than that, there are many fewer people crossing now. Contrary to what people say, and I know there was someone on one of the news shows that was talking about his brother was killed by an undocumented alien who was in this country. And of course that's going to happen. But I think the statistics show that the number of serious crimes by undocumented people in this country is much less than crime by citizens of the country, meaning percentage-wise. So that's certainly one thing. And what always amazes me is the focus on the border. Yes, it's absolutely true that people are coming from Central America to seek amnesty. And they have a right to do it, of course. And more people probably have been coming across border illegally. That was not a felony, but it's a misdemeanor. And the reason they're doing that is they have slowed down the process for people seeking amnesty to report at the ports of entry. So what happens, and at least this is what people who've come across the borders have told me, and especially with the women and the children, is they will cross. They'll come into either Texas or Arizona, maybe California, and they will literally sit down and wait for the Border Patrol. So they know they're going to get picked up. They're not trying to even evade the Border Patrol. They're just coming in that way because it takes so long to come through the ports of entry because of the slowdown. So whatever, you know, you think about this, do we need to spend the kind of money? And we're talking, every estimate, every true estimate is more than $40 billion, even to partially build the wall. And there are some places where it might be helpful. I'm not going to say it's not. But the other thing that is amazing to me is, we have coastlines. So many of the people coming from Mexico, you know, they can take boats. I'm not even going to talk about going under the wall, but certainly they can take boats around the wall. They can take planes, which, you know, fly into some of these small airports or, you know, cattle fields, corn fields, I should say. That's what's going to happen. And believe me, some of those pilots, because I've lived down in Central America, and they can land and take off from anywhere. So, you know, I'm not saying that there doesn't need to be something done, but frankly, I think it's outrageous to suggest, because the powers that be know that Mexico is not going to write a check for billions of dollars. It's outrageous to say that all of these people coming across are coming and they're going to be terrorists or are terrorists. And frankly, I think it's, you know, pretty outrageous that we're focusing totally on the border and not paying attention to all of the people who legally come into this country on some type of visa, but when it expires, they don't leave. In other words, they can come in on a visitor's visa, they can come in on a student visa, and, you know, when it expires, they just don't want to leave. And there seems to be no concern or at least no money being spent to deal with this population. So that the other thing, of course, that anyone who knows anything about our immigration laws knows that they're just really unfair, antiquated, and not enforceable. And to have this become this political football, and here we are on January 11th, and all of these federal workers are not going to get paid. And, you know, most of these federal workers who, the ones who have to work and still are required to work, and the ones who, you know, are totally laid off, you know, they don't have the resources. And how many people in this country have the resources to miss a few paychecks? Not many. So, to me, this is just a game of egos. And it's totally outrageous also that the DACA kids, you know, that something's not being done for them. We no longer in this country have a reputation of being humanitarians. And I think that was always the one thing that we prided ourselves on. If something happened, everybody was there to work together, etc. No longer. Now, I also wanted to make a quick comment on the Jamie Kloss case in Wisconsin. We'll certainly learn more about this. I think everybody is just elated that she was able to escape her kidnapper. Pretty incredible, from what I understand, beyond what the news said, is she either went up to the door or saw a woman walking her dog, explained who she was. My understanding, the best information, is that she went up to this woman's door and actually may have walked in and asked her to call 911. That area, 40 miles, about 40 miles, Gordon is about 40 miles southeast of Duluth, Minnesota. So it's over in an area in kind of the middle of Wisconsin, a little bit south. But over in the in Wisconsin, it's in the western part of Wisconsin. So, you know, the tragedy, of course, is the person in custody apparently is the one who also killed her parents. It seems that it had been well thought out, and but thank goodness that she's alive. And the unfortunate, of course, the tragedy is not only was she kidnapped, but her parents were killed. So, back to kind of the mundane in New Jersey, but that if anyone can help with this fear-mongering that is going on through the present administration, and frankly, I think a lot of it is to deflect attention from serious problems that have been uncovered as a result of the Mueller investigation. I mean, this is really serious concerns about the Russian influence and the fact that although we don't know that it actually changed the election, it certainly impacted it. But getting back to cases, and I did want to talk about one case, and I was hoping that Bill would come in, and because there's an NFL case about tickets that I thought was interesting. But this is about farmland assessment. This woman, the plaintiff, appealed the denial of her 2017 farmland assessment application by the borough of Lincoln Park. And that was affirmed by the County Board of Taxation, and so this is the tax court decision. So alternatively, plaintiff challenged the local property tax assessment on her property, and she said the property was 15 and 3/4 acres of vacant land. And from 1986 through 2016, it was qualified as farmland assessment. In her 2017 application, plaintiff claimed that the entire property was actively devoted to agriculture or horticultural uses. And they would, of course, that would enable her to get farmland assessment. So when the assessor inspected plaintiff's property, the assessor concluded that much of the property was not being used for farmland purposes, and that many of the activities alleged by plaintiff's application were not happening. Instead, the assessor determined that more than 80% of the property was forest-like and unsuitable for farming. And accordingly, the borough denied plaintiff's application and imposed a standard assessment. Now, there's also, of course, a possibility of certain assessments, and I'm not exactly sure how that works, for example, Christmas tree farms, which, you know, they're trees, so I can't clarify why her forest was not, could not qualify. However, what the court did is they affirmed the denial of plaintiff's farmland assessment application and directed the matter to proceed on her challenge to the local property tax assessment. In other words, for the value. They said it would be standard value, but the question was, what was the value of the property? The court noted that plaintiff bore the burden to prove her property met the requirements for farmland assessment. Court further noted in support of her appeal that plaintiff claimed to have measured 7 acres of agriculture activity, less than the 15 acres claimed in her application. Thus, the court found plaintiff's testimony to be self-serving and not credible. So that's interesting. On appeal, she didn't say that the 15 acres were should be farmland assessed, but only 7. So the court ruled that the plaintiff failed to establish her measurement was accurate, reliable, and verifiable. The court also held that plaintiff impermissibly counted acreage of unmanaged land and naturally occurring crops, and concurred with the assessor's conclusion that the property was substantially unmanaged woodlands. So that's the what I was forgetting. It has to be managed woodlands and not just woodlands, apparently, to prevail. And so the court concluded that plaintiffs failed to show that not less than 5 acres of her property was actively devoted to agriculture and or horticultural use as required for farmland assessment. So that's true. You have to have a minimum of 5 acres. And in fact, if there is less than, you can't count also the house, etc. So in New Jersey, you have to have more than 5 acres in order to comply. So the last case I did want to talk about during the last few minutes was this case, Finkelman, on behalf of himself and a putative class against the National Football League. And the reason this came back to New Jersey, and in fact it was our Supreme Court, is that, and Justice Patterson wrote the opinion. I'm sure that many of us who are football fans might wish that it would have been changed. But in any event, the questions that came back from the Third Circuit was whether or not the plaintiff properly had pleaded a claim under the New Jersey ticket law. So we do have a ticket law. And that, in case anyone is interested in looking, is NJSA 56:8-35.1. And the that act was in force when this case arose. And the pertinent part states that it shall be an unlawful practice for a person who has access to tickets to an event prior to the ticket's release for sale to the general public to withhold those tickets from sale to the general public in an amount exceeding 5% of all available seating for the event. Seems a little, you know, lots of stuff in that. But it's interesting because what seems to me interesting to me and probably to most football fans is that the NFL has an established practice for football games. And in before that game, they only sold 1% of the tickets to members of the public. And that was the members of the public who had won the right to purchase those tickets in an NFL-sponsored lottery. And they gave the remaining 99% to teams, to broadcast networks, to corporate sponsors, and other individuals and entities. So what every football fan, and my good friend Bill Wolfson has just joined me, and he is certainly a football fan, and he will be really interested in the games this weekend because his team is actually playing. We'll talk about that in the Sports Guys, which we will pick up right after the news. But in any event, the question here was, you know, not the 1% and the 99% actually, but was the question, did they withhold an excessive percentage of those tickets contrary to the section of the statute? And so in this case, Mr. Finkelman, in his own capacity and as a representative of a proposed class of individuals, and he considered the proposed class to be either the individuals who bought 2014 Super Bowl tickets at premium prices on the secondary market or could not afford to do so because of the cost. And so the plaintiff in this case sought various remedies, including treble damages, and I've talked about that before. Treble damages, you can get treble damages under the Consumer Fraud Act, which we call the CFA, and that's NJSA 56:8-1-210. So what happened, of course, is United, in this case, is the district court for the District of New Jersey dismissed the case and the plaintiff appealed. And an appeal in the federal court is up to the Third Circuit, and the Third Circuit submitted the following certified question to the state, and that is, does plaintiff Josh Finkelman properly plead a claim under the New Jersey ticket law? And I guess we're going to have to end there. We'll be right back after the news, and we'll be back with the Sports Guys, and today the Sports Guys, Bill Wolfson and Pat Smits. See you in a few minutes.
USA Radio News.
Wisconsin police are giving more details as to the discovery of 13-year-old Jamie Kloss, who went missing in October after her parents were found killed. Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald talks about Jamie Kloss.
She is good. She's been cleared from the hospital. There is a reunification process in place going on right now.
And as far as the suspect, Jake Patterson, Fitzgerald says,
Jake Patterson had zero criminal history locally and zero criminal history in the state of Wisconsin.
On Friday at the White House, President Trump held a roundtable on border security. This as the partial government shutdown continues, to which Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says, enough of the showboating.
The last thing we need to do right now is to trade pointless, absolutely pointless, show votes back and forth across the aisle.
The two sides still seem very far apart regarding
Sorry, don't know about you, but I can't stand hearing. I can't stand hearing any more about this. You know, the two sides in this fight over the border, which, you know, and this so-called temporary shutdown of the government. I'm just so sick of seeing anyone try to justify the fact that there is a shutdown of the government, and all of these people, and all these people aren't getting paid. And of course, I don't understand why our dear president, since he said Mexico is going to pay for the wall, why all of a sudden